Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue our broadcast of dance music. We shall continue now with our piano interlude.
We are being hypnotized by people like this. Newsreaders, politicians, teachers, lecturers.
We are in a country and in a world that is being run by unbelievably sick people. The chasm between what we're told is going on and what is really going on is absolutely enormous.
Oh yeah, dude. There's some Nephilim shit. It's like we all know what's going down, but no one's saying shit. What happened to the home of the brave? These motherfuckers, they controlling us now, and no one's talking about how they made us try to be slaves. And everybody's just walking around, head in the clouds, and won't awaken to a dead in the grave. But then it's too late, we need to be ready to raise up. Welcome to the end of day. Everybody is slaves, only some are aware.
Welcome back, everybody, to Nephilim Death Squad. I am David Lee Corbo, a.k.a. The Raven. That is the father of disinformation, Top Lobster. And this is a special edition of Nephilim Death Squad, something that we're still kind of figuring out the name. Dissecting the Book of Revelation, maybe, is what we'll go with. But here to guide us along that journey, returning for the second time in 2 weeks, is Ed Mabry. Last time we did an episode, Ed, we just kind of whetted everyone's appetite about, you know, what we're going to be getting into. And so I would say this is the first like official episode of that.
David, exactly. One thing, your mic seems just a little bit hot, but I wanted to congratulate Ed on not only, I mean, you're making our Mount Crushmore, but you're also breaking records. First back-to-back episode, and then first person to be on three times. So I'm happy that it's you. I'm happy that it's you. Because when I heard you on Tinfoil Hat, I was like, this is the guy. This dude...
No, I'm honored. I'm glad. Thanks to you guys for having me. I really appreciate it. And let me know how my mic. I'm turning down the my input down a little bit.
Oh no, your levels were good, Ed. It was okay. David that was.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant my levels. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, no, you're good. So yeah, again, thank you for coming and doing this with us. I guess this will be our first actual episode. The last one was a primer.
Right.
I just tweeted out to the people, if you want to know why you feel like you're living through biblical prophecy, this is a good place to start. Yep, this video here. And I truly believe that. I'm excited for you to get into it. So, I mean, take the floor, Ed. Let us know.
Yeah. So again, thanks for having me back. I'm excited to do this. This is like my passion is just teaching in general and this book specifically because it's such a fascinating book and it's so apropos for these times. And so last time, gave an introduction and we talked about the kind of the perspective of it, like the divine perspective that this is, you know, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him. So this is God the Father, Jehovah, Yahweh, talking to Jesus and revealing his plan back to Jesus, you know, after he first ascends, you know, and after his death and resurrection, and Jesus kind of giving him a download and that we get to eavesdrop on through the Apostle John, who has the honor and the privilege of writing down these visions. And so, yeah, these are a bunch of several visions that he was given. It says in the first few verses that God, Jesus, sent and signified it, rendered this conversation between the Father and the Son into signs for the churches, for all the churches. We're going to talk specifically about the seven churches that were given this message, but it's a message for everyone, and we'll see exactly in a bit why it's such a global message and how those seven churches translate to all of the churches. So you could technically say that the first three chapters of Revelation are technically the most important for us because I think they are a part of the present, whereas the rest is the future. And I'll talk about what that means in a moment, but just to set the stage of where this is happening. So you have the Apostle John. He's one of the original 12 disciples. This is about 95 AD. So he's an old man at this point. He's probably in his 80s, late 80s. And He is the last living disciple. All the other ones have been martyred, including, you know, including the Apostle Paul, which wasn't one of the 12, but he was, you know, obviously a very important apostle. He wrote most of the New Testament. They're all gone. They've all been killed. He's the only one who's left alive. He's actually the only, it's believed he's the only one who never, who died of a natural causes. But at this point, he has been arrested. He's on an island called Patmos. It's kind of a penal colony in the middle of the Mediterranean, like off of the island of Crete. And it says he was in the spirit on the Lord's day. Most of your Bibles will say that. But a better, well, I think a more accurate description is he was in the spirit on the day of the Lord. Okay, what does that mean? What's the difference between the Lord's Day and the Day of the Lord? Well, when you say the Lord's Day, a lot of people think that means Sunday. He was in a spiritual state on a Sunday. Well, maybe, but I don't think that's what was happening. First of all, Sunday worship, John was a Jew. You know, he worshiped on the Sabbath on Saturday. So Sunday worship didn't really become a thing until like Roman Catholicism in around the 3rd-4th century started to become powerful. So no, it said he was in spirit on the Day of the Lord. The Day of the Lord in the Old Testament is that final period of judgment that, you know, Christians call the tribulation, the last 7 years of human rule on the earth. So he was basically saying he was transported to the future. This is like an overall statement. I was transported spiritually to the day of the Lord, the time of the final judgment where he renders everything out. And he was given this vision and told to send it to 7 churches in Asia Minor, which is modern day Turkey. So these 7 churches are Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. So why these 7 churches? They all have very specific issues, problems, and opportunities that relate to us individually, church communities, and to all of church history. And these are actually epistles written by Jesus. So, you know, we have the epistles of Peter, the epistles of Paul, epistles of John. Well, these are epistles of Jesus. These are Jesus's own, his 7 testaments, you could say, to the churches. And the next thing, John turns to see who was talking to him and saying, you know, hey, I've got this vision for you. And he turns and he sees a vision of Jesus, but it's not like the Jesus he saw. This is the first set of signs. He sees Jesus. He said he had hair the color of wool. He had feet that were like bronze. He had a white robe and a golden sash, and he walked among 7 lampstands, and he had in his hand 7 stars. Okay, these are all signs. Like the white hair is a sign of purity. The bronze feet are a sign of judgment. Bronze is considered in biblical terms, it symbolizes judgment, because bronze was the metal that could retain heat. And heat and judgment is always through fire. His long robe was priestly. The gold sash was royalty, because gold was the material of royalty. So he's a king. He's a priest. He has conquered judgment, because judgment was at his feet. So again, in these terms, that's why it's really so important that we read the Bible, any part of the Bible, or frankly, any ancient text, with the context of the people who it was being written to and their culture, not ours. So in their culture, something being under your feet meant you conquered it. So that means Jesus conquered judgment. And the 7 lampstands were, again, those the 7 churches, and we're given a definition of the 7 stars in his hand were the 7 angels, the 7 angelos, or messengers of those churches. And as that chapter ends, the first chapter ends, John is given an outline of the whole book. John is told to write the things you have seen, the things which are, and the things which shall be after these things. The Greek word for after these things is metatauta. So the things he has seen was just the vision we just talked about. The things which are the 7 churches, and the things which shall be after these things, or after the churches, or after the church age, is that future, that day of the Lord.
Ed, if I could interject for a moment.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Just listening to the way you're talking about this, especially when you said, I forgot what the terminology you used was, but God put all this in signs.
Signified it. Yes.
So what's interesting about that is this is, you know, something that's incredibly important, and it's literally written in signs. Mm-hmm. And as a culture today, we've lost that. We're so far from that art form, being able to understand that. And in fact, if you do look for signs and symbols and trying to understand them and the meaning and the hidden message of things, that's, you know, that's, you're a conspiracy theorist. So it's just phenomenal to me that to hear you say that is like, oh, the ways in which you might argue my brain is broken, right? I'm looking too deep into things. I'm trying to understand meaning, you know, under layers when really it's should be taken at face value is, I mean, we talk about it quite often on this show, Hollywood and the music industry, they inundate you with symbols. The language is still alive and well, but it's being utilized by only one side of the fence, and the general public is nullified to it. We don't even understand what we're looking at. And here we have God putting this incredibly important message in symbols. We should always have been able to understand symbols, and we've lost that entirely.
Exactly. I'm gonna get way ahead of myself and just kind of expound on what you said. In Revelation chapter 12, which we'll obviously get to down the line, there is this other very complex vision of a woman who is clothed with the sun, with the moon at her feet, 12 stars above her head, who's being chased by a dragon while she's giving birth to a child. The whole point of that is that's a story. These signs, these symbols, they are all stories. What's the old saying, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. You see a symbol, there's a whole story in that. Why is that important? Because I think we may have mentioned this before. I know I talk about it all the time on my podcast on faithbyreason.net, that stories are the language of eternity. Stories are eternal. Any story you've heard, you can just put yourself in that story at any point, and it's like you were there. Like, for example, when I was growing up, I grew up on Star Wars, the original Star Wars, not the crap that Disney has been doing. But my favorite movie is The Empire Strikes Back in the Star Wars series. And I love it because it's like it's a chase film. It has, you know, it has Luke learning about the Force from Yoda and all that kind of stuff. I know what's going to happen. I've seen it literally 100 times, but I can put it on right now. I put it on, I think, on whatever. We have my old DVDs of it. I'll still feel all the same things I felt, even though I know what's going to happen. And think about your favorite story. You can immerse yourself in that story immediately, and you will feel everything that you felt, think all the same things you thought, even though you know what's going to happen. Why? Because they're eternal. And God is eternal. Stories are the eternal language. So,
you know, and not only that, I just had to have my wife get me coffee because I saw you sipping on your coffee. not only that, but like the stories are... What's a good way to put this? The stories themselves are eternal, right? If you're talking about like the hero's journey and things of that nature, one of my favorite films, and I don't know if you like it, but since you're a Star Wars guy, this may put us in direct opposition with one another. But I was a big Lord of the Rings guy.
Oh, I love Lord of the Rings. It's no opposition. I'm a huge fan.
It's a phenomenal story, and if you just take, you know, the Return of the King, right, mm-hmm. when it comes to Aragorn's story arc. If you take the suffering of Frodo Baggins carrying basically the sin of mankind, right, in the form of the ring, and then you take the resurrection of Gandalf, it is the story of Jesus broken up into different characters that play different moments. And there's a reason why that movie is so... I mean, even Harry Potter, the boy who lived, you know, there's a lot of biblical... sort of flavoring, not even flavoring. I mean, it's essentially a ripoff, you know, of different elements of the Bible. But the reason Star Wars, Harry Potter, Lord of the Rings, these are, we just named three of the biggest blockbuster films in history. And the reason that they resonate so deeply and they are so successful is because they're biblical in nature. And these stories are ancient and eternal.
Yeah. I love that you said that because you were getting on one of my favorite topics, and we'll go off topic. I don't care. We'll get back to it. But because I've done other podcasts that were different subjects that were in different areas about stories. I mean, because I love stories. There are only five stories or five story themes. Every satisfying story you've ever heard is one or more of the following. It's either the hero's journey, which you just talked about. There is the journey of discovery. which where that's so the hero's journey, you know that, you know, someone goes from obscurity, they learn, they have something special about them, they get trained, they have the ultimate battle, and at the end they either get the love of their life, they get some kind of prize, they learn and grow and all that. So you know that part. Then they have the journey of discovery. That's Harry Potter. It's a journey of discovery. It's a person starts out not knowing who they really are. And somewhere along the line, they learn who they really are. They learn their true power and they learn to live in that power. Then you have the redemption arc, which Star Wars actually is. The big picture of Star Wars, yeah, the first, I would say the prequels and the first three was the redemption of Darth Vader. The redemptive arc is someone who starts either morally ambiguous or they're basically a bad guy, and they see someone sees good in them, and they see the good in themselves, and they become redeemed. So that's the redemptive arc. Then you have the spiritual awakening. A perfect example of that is the Matrix. Mm-hmm. The spiritual awakening is about someone who gets it's similar to the journey of discovery, but it's all spiritual. It's about believing. Like Neo had to learn to believe. Then he got his power, and then he learned to live in it. And the last one is the tragedy. And then the tragedy, that's when someone pays the ultimate price for it's like the hero's journey, but the hero either loses something or often their life. In Lord of the Rings, Frodo's story was a tragedy, because he could never go back to the Shire. He tried, but he had been too damaged. He had to go, you know, so that was the tragedy arc. And the thing is that all of those five are part of the Bible story. The redemptive arc is man's story. The hero's journey, that's the story of Jesus. The tragedy is Jehovah, God's story. Because remember, at the end, when we get to the end, God doesn't actually gain anything. He gets back what he originally wanted, which was Eden. We talked about that last time. God loses constantly in the Bible. He's always losing battles. Man doesn't do what he wants. The Elohim, the Nephilim, he keeps taking L's. And then Jesus, he commissions Jesus as his hero, but all he does is just basically get Jehovah back what he originally wanted. Then you have spiritual awakenings. There's tons of those. And so they're all these, like you said, with Lord of the Rings, there's all these mini arcs. You know, Gandalf had his resurrection arc. Frodo's a tragedy. Sam and Aragorn have the hero's journey. So you have all of those elements, and that's why those stories all resonate with us, because all of those five stories are Jehovah's story. They're all in the Bible, and they all speak to us on this deep heart level. And we wonder, why do we love these stories so much? Because they're the stories of our Creator.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
On the last episode, we spoke with Dr. Narco Longo, and he was putting out a theory that the fruit which Eve and Adam ate from was actually a mushroom. This is the tree of knowledge that opened up their eyes to see what was going on, and they weren't supposed to do that. Because when they were in the Garden of Eden, they were kind of like, they were perfect beings until they weren't, right? So in my head, they didn't really become man or human until they weren't perfect anymore, because otherwise, that's kind of like an angel, right? Like, just a thing that kind of do no wrong. And it feels like God's not interested in that. He's not interested in making something that will just only worship him and can't do wrong. He's interested in the part where it's presented to you that you could sin, but instead you choose his story anyway.
Right, so, like love means nothing without the being able to choose.
Exactly. Sure. So, that was just the point I was about to make. Go ahead.
In the end, when, you know, New Jerusalem comes down and the people who believe in God and Jesus are supposed to be there, that has to be like it doesn't make sense for him to then just turn our consciousness into this, you know, only this, I cannot do any wrong. I will only, it's like, it almost feels like the conditions there that would be created would have to be perfect, and we wouldn't really have any issues. Like, we would live well. You understand what I'm getting at?
I know what you're saying. It's something that I wondered about too. And in my last episode that I think that's on my site, where I actually talk about the New Jerusalem and the eternity. So we have this idea, a lot of Christians have this idea that once you get to heaven, like, you're going to be zapped, you're going to know everything, and you're going to be perfect, and you're never going to make a mistake. No, it's clear when we get there, we'll see it, that we're going to make mistakes. Now, there's a difference between a mistake and a sin. A sin is about an intention of doing evil. A mistake is not necessarily a sin. For example, you know, this morning when you sent me an email saying, hey, can you come on at this time? And I didn't read it in time. And so we had to kind of scramble to get here. That was a mistake. It wasn't a sin. I didn't do anything intentionally wrong, but it was a mistake that I can learn from. So we're in the eternity, we're still going to learn. We're going to, let's say, you know, God forbid, I die tomorrow. And let's say I go to heaven. Hopefully, that's what I believe. I'm not going to know more than I knew yesterday. I'm going to grow, and we're going to learn. And it says in that there's a tree in the New Jerusalem that's for the leaves are for the healing of the nations, or the healing of the people. Well, why would you need to heal if you were perfect? Healing is repairing. So we're going to spend eternity learning, growing, interacting, and repairing. And there will be mistakes. They won't be sin, but they will be mistakes. We're going to continue to learn and grow and become better and better as we learn from each other. As we, and you know, let's say that, you know, you, we interact with each other. I learned something from you, Top, and you learned something from me. And now I know what I know, and I know what you know. Now I can pass that on to someone else, and we can go on and on. We continue interacting like that forever, and continuing to grow and become more and more like God. So back to Eden and what the fruit was, I don't know. I can't say exactly what people say is an apple. That's mythology. But whatever the fruit was, it was the choice. I don't even think it doesn't matter what, in my opinion, it doesn't matter what the fruit happened to be. What matters is what the intention was behind it. So when Adam and Eve, the reason that they were sinless, because it said they have no knowledge. They didn't have knowledge of good and evil. So what's the definition of good and evil? Good is that which creates in the long term. So we know that the definition of good, because we first see it in the Bible. The first time we see the word good is during creation, when God creates whatever and he says, this is good. Good creates, and it creates in the long term. You can destroy in the short term to build in the long term. Let's say, for example, I buy a piece of property that has an old decrepit barn on it, and I want to build my dream house. Well, I've got to knock the barn down first. I got to destroy the barn so I can create my dream home. So yeah, there's temporary destruction, but long-term is creation. So it's what creates in the long-term. Evil is the opposite. Evil is that which destroys in the long-term. And again, so evil can look good in the short-term. Let's say, you know, something like drugs. You know, you take heroin in the short-term, you feel great. You know, you're high, but then that's short-term. Long-term though, it destroys you. So that's what evil is. So what Adam and Eve didn't have knowledge of was the long term. They lived in the present. They didn't have to think beyond a moment because they were in perfect communion with God. They were in the present. That's what eternity is. Eternity is a constant present. That's what a story is. A story, you are constantly, Empire Strikes Back. I can see everything that's happening in my mind immediately. I don't have to start at the beginning. I can go in at any point. It's a constant present. When they ate from the tree, what they did, they intentionally disconnected themselves from God. So they no longer live in the present because they didn't have God. They're like, what, you eat this? I'm no longer, I disobeyed him. I'm not connected anymore. Now they have to start thinking about the long term. That's when they said, what?
It's like they unplugged from the matrix.
Right. It's like, I'm no longer covered. That term naked doesn't just mean that they were, you know, didn't have any clothes on. It means they were uncovered. They were covered with light by Jehovah. I mean, that's a whole other story we can get into another time. They were uncovered, and they said, I need to cover myself, because, you know, they suddenly realized that they weren't perfect, that they, as you were saying, Top, they realized, I'm human. I have flaws. I need to cover up because Jehovah's coming to walk with me during the cool of the day, which is what he would do regularly. So that's what the fall is all about, and that's in learning. So when the serpent, or the Nakash, the shining one is the actual definition, when he told them, hey, he told them a lie and a truth. He said, if you eat the fruit, you will not surely die. That was a lie. But you will be like the Elohim, like the God, knowing good and evil, knowing the long term. So he was correct with that. But they did die, because death is the inability to repair. Life is the ability to repair. That's why we're alive now, because, you know, our cells are always taking damage, but we can repair it. Once you get to the point where you can no longer repair, your organs fail and you die. So they did start to, and it's, the term is, you know, if you eat of this fruit, in dying, you will die. You will begin the process of not being able to repair permanently. But in the New Jerusalem, we will be able to repair permanently the tree, the leaves of the tree for the healing of the nations. So I know we got off topic there, but you know me, I give me a rabbit hole, I'm going down it.
So, all right. So let's jump back onto where we left off on Revelations. We were talking about, I think the last thing we were mentioning was how everything was, what was the word again, Ed? Signified?
Yeah, it's signified, rendered into signs.
Okay.
Yeah. So the letters to the churches, which
right, letters to the churches. So,
super important.
Yeah. So here's what's so cool about those letters. So there are, I would say, at least four different levels of the letters. The first is a contemporary state. That is that these were actual churches in the first century. You know, Smyrna, Ephesus, Thyatira, all these were actual cities. They were actual cities in Asia Minor, modern day Turkey, and they all had churches. So these letters were to them, and they talked about where they were doing well, what they weren't doing well, and how to how to be better. Also, it's each one of the letters ends with John through Jesus writing, "He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches." So these letters were meant to be exchanged through by all the churches. So they were all for all churches. So all churches to some degree had these issues. And it says, "He who has an ear, you have an ear, I have an ear. These churches, these letters are for us." So each one of us have the same issues, opportunities that these churches had. And the final level, I think is the most provocative, is the prophetic level. And that is that these seven letters, in the order in which they were written, outlines church history in advance. Each one of these are a period of time from the first century apostolic age all the way up to our current age. And I believe we're in that last age of the Church of Laodicea. And so as we go through this, I'll point out where these things are historically and, you know, and how they progress through it. And one more that I didn't have on my website, because when I went through it, I wasn't aware of this. I actually learned this a little later on. And actually, Top, you mentioned last time about a trial, and these letters also are germane to this big trial. And this trial is something that began in the book of Daniel, chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, for those who are familiar with it, it's the famous vision that Daniel has of the four beasts who represent the four world empires. One was a lion, there was a bear, there was a leopard, and an indescribable beast. And when the prophecy is revealed, the lion was Babylon, which is the empire that Daniel was under. Then the bear was Medo-Persia, which was the next empire that actually Daniel lived through part of. Then the leopard was the Greek empire, and the powerful indescribable beast was the Roman empire that, you know, was the strongest of the empires. And again, I think persists to this day through the Vatican, frankly, because the Roman empire never fell. All those other empires were conquered. You know, the Persians conquered Medo-Persia conquered Babylon. The Greeks conquered the Persians. The Romans conquered the Greek. Rome, no one ever conquered Rome. Rome just went from a senatorial, an imperial, a representative sort of a dictatorship to a theocracy. And we're going to talk about that when we get to the letter of Thyatira. And it rules the world to this day. The Vatican still has enormous power. They spawned the Jesuits, and the Jesuits sponsored the world bankers, the Medicis and the Orsinis, who sponsored the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers, and all the 13 families and all the stuff, all of the other stuff we talk about in conspiracy theories. They're not even theories, they're conspiracy facts.
I don't know at this point if we're just right, embracing the terminology or, you know, but we know what you mean.
The point of this is that here's what was happening in this vision that Daniel saw in the spiritual realm. There is a law, a principle that you have to speak something in one realm so that it manifests in the other realm. That is a principle. God does the same principle. He spoke the world into existence. He spoke the world into, he said, "Let there be light, let there be land," so forth and so on. And it manifested in the other realm, the physical realm. So that's what they have to do. So what was going on with these four beasts was the bad guys, the evil Elohim, the fallen angels, speaking their plan for how they're going to take over. Their plan is, we're going to take over this earth through these four empires, the successive empires ending with the huge empire, the Roman Empire, which will be the empire through which they're going to take over the world. So because they said it, it's going to happen. It is happening. We've seen it happen. But they've stated their will. Then when, after they stated their will, the next thing you see is a trial where God, where Jehovah says, oh, okay, that's your plan. Cool. Here's my counter. And so it says the books were, he said, you saw a throne set up and the Ancient of Days were set on the throne. That's Jehovah, that's God. And books were opened and there were thrones set. So you have in the Jewish mind, that's a trial. You have God serving as a judge. You have the books opened with all of the, you know, the things that the fallen angels are doing, and you have these thrones set up. That's kind of the jury, for lack of a better term.
Today's episode is brought to you by HeavensHarvest.com. In times of uncertainty, peace of mind is priceless, and Heaven's Harvest has your back with the highest quality emergency survival foods and heirloom seeds. They have survival food kits for emergencies that last a week all the way up to 12 weeks. Choose from protein kits, entree kits, breakfast, fruits and veg, and even organic kits for you bougie survivalists. Don't forget to check out their heirloom seeds and choose from their vegetable kits, artisan seed kits, superfood kits, and more. They even have water filtration units. Build your stockpile without breaking the bank by visiting HeavensHarvest.com and using promo code Nephilim at checkout. That's promo code Nephilim, NEPHILIM, for 5% off your entire order.
And then you saw a vision of what's called the Son of Man riding on a cloud, who was given all the nations. That's basically the conclusion. The Son of Man riding on the cloud is Jesus. That's why Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man, because the Son of Man meaning a human being riding on the clouds. The riding on the clouds was an idiom for God, for Yahweh, because Yahweh, the Jews, ancient Jews considered Yahweh, they called him the cloud rider because, you know, during the Exodus, he was on a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So he was called the cloud rider. So you have a man with the authority of Jehovah, that's Jesus, who will inherit all the nations. Okay, what does it have to do with these seven letters of seven churches? Well, keep in mind that the trial is ongoing, even though Jehovah's already given the final verdict, but we just don't know how. We know what's going to happen, but we don't know the details yet. These seven letters are how the church is supposed to interact with the world in order to be on the jury. And we're going to see in chapter 4, and I'm getting ahead of myself, I'm going to talk about this a lot more when we get to chapter 4, but the church, believers, are the jury. We're the ones who are going to be giving the final judgment of guilty or innocent for the Elohim. Remember, there's a verse, I don't have it off the top of my head, but the Apostle Paul says, we will judge Elohim.
Meaning that's believers. That's where this happens. That's the most disrespectful thing to them that could, right? Because this whole thing was just because they hated us. That's really what, and then to have that come around and that's like, well, now they're going to judge you. It's like,
yeah,
man.
It's the relationship they have with us. I wouldn't call it love hate. It's more like, I want you to worship me, but I hate you.
Yeah.
They covet our worship, but they also despise us. So let's run through quickly what's going on with the churches. Let's see how far we get. So the first church is Ephesus. That was, again, a city in ancient Turkey. It was where it was considered in Rome the city of the goddess Diana, in Ephesus means the beloved or betrothed. And the people in Ephesus, what Jesus told them essentially is, you know, you guys are great with doctrine. You guys have your doctrine down. Nobody can fool you. You don't tolerate false prophets. However, you left your first love. You don't have love in your heart. So they were great on doctrine. They were weak on love. It says you left your first love, your first or primary love. It's supposed to be your love for Jesus. So like my old mentor, Chuck Missler, would say, they were so busy doing the work of the king, they had no time for the king. So, and this resonates with me personally because this is where I have a flaw.
Me too.
I think I'm great with doctrine, but I don't always spend time with God. And that's something that I constantly work on doing more. So they were told basically as far as how to interact with the world, speak the truth in love. So they were great at speaking the truth, but they needed to do it in love. And they were told that if they do that, their reward would be they would eat from the tree of life. So the next church was Smyrna. The city of Smyrna was a very, like Ephesus, it was a very wealthy city, but the church was persecuted because they wouldn't worship Caesar. They wouldn't worship the, you know, the Roman ruler. So they were persecuted and they suffered. And Jesus had nothing negative to say about them. He just told them, you know, you think you're poor, but you're actually rich. You're physically poor, but you're spiritually rich. And just endure suffering. And if you endure the suffering, you will, you know, you'll have eternal life. So Ephesus symbolized the apostolic church, the church of like the first century, where they had great doctrine because they were alive during the time of Peter and Paul and John and all the disciples. But again, they were, their love wasn't strong. So that's like the first century. The church of Smyrna was basically at the second and third century, where they were getting a lot of persecution from Rome. The Romans, you know, you had all these emperors like, you know, Hadrian and Diocletian, who were just very anti-Christian and were driving them underground into the catacombs, where they were just told to endure. The third church is a church at Pergamum or Pergamos. They were told that in the letter, Jesus said, you know, you have, I know where your church is. You are where Satan's throne is. And there was, you know, keep in mind that the fallen Elohim, the fallen angels are not omnipresent like God is. They're local. They are in a specific area. And this is where Satan's physical throne was at that time. But their problem was they were compromised.
Where was it? where was that? Very important.
Map-wise, if you go to faithbyreason.net and go to the episode on Pergamus, you can show it's you can see the map. I have a map of where all these churches are. And it was basically like north central Turkey. It doesn't mean he's there now. I frankly think his throne room is in the Vatican. But at that time, that was where he was ruling from.
That's interesting. I know I hear a lot of people say that the throne of Satan or Lucifer is in Geneva, Switzerland.
I just want to show this real quick and encourage our guys to go there. Someone in the chat said that they've been binge listening to Ed. So
that's awesome.
And check out his website too. Yeah, I'm sure we'll pull this back up as we, you know, make our journey through. But important, go to the website.
yeah, please do. I mean, I'm giving you the big overview. I mean, I spend like a half an hour to an hour on each one of these churches, so you're kind of getting the Reader's Digest version. So the problem with Pergamum, and by the way, what's cool is that each one of these church names means something. Like I said, Ephesus meant beloved. Smyrna was myrrh. You could actually hear it in the Smyrna myrrh. Myrrh was one of the gifts that the wise men brought to Jesus, but myrrh was an embalming material. You had to if you squeeze it and it has a strong scent, and they would use it for embalming. So the church of Smyrna, they were being persecuted. They were being squeezed. Then you have Pergamum, which means mixed or undesirable, and gamos means union or marriage. So this means an undesirable or mixed marriage. This was a church that married the world. They compromised with the world for material stuff, for riches. And they were told, you know, that, you know, don't compromise. So their message was, don't compromise with the world. And this is indicative of the church of the fourth century during the time of Constantine. And this was the genesis of the Roman church. You know the story of Constantine. He was the last purely secular Roman emperor. He had this famous battle called the Battle of Milvian Bridge, where he was trying to reunite the empire. And he claimed he saw a sign of the cross before that famous battle with the words, "In this sign, conquer." And he went out and he won the battle. And he says, okay, I saw the cross. I'm going to become a Christian now. And he legalized Christianity, which was a great relief to the Christians. They were not only were they no longer persecuted, but he favored Christians at court, and they were able to come out and they were able to actually become part of society. And because the Roman emperor favored them, they started gaining riches. Now, whether or not Constantine actually converted to Christianity is debatable. I don't think he did. I think he was just a savvy politician who realized that religion is a great way to unite people. And the Christian religion, these Christians, they were, you know, they were humble, they were hardworking. You know, I think he found they would be the least offensive religion for him to get behind. But Constantine also named himself the head of the church. He called himself Pontifex Maximus, mm-hmm. which is the same title that the Pope holds to this day. He calls himself that. So the first pope was not Peter. Sorry to my Catholic friends out there. There's no evidence that Peter, the Apostle Peter, was ever a pope. He never ruled from Rome. He never had any of the pomp and circumstance of the pope. The first pope was Constantine. He was the first person to call himself Pontifex Maximus and to lead a church stationed in Rome. His third successor, he had two more successors that came after him, and they kind of went back and forth between outlawing Christianity again or keeping them around. But finally, his third successor named Theodosius, he not only made Christianity, he re-legalized it, he made it the official religion of the Roman Empire. So, and he forced all the pagans to convert to Christianity under penalty of death, which was, you know, not how you should get Christians, by putting a gun to their head. But because of this, all the pagans basically were forced to go to church, but they were still pagans. So how did they keep the peace? Well, they did it by compromising with the pagans and say, you know, mm-hmm. what, you can bring some of your gods in. We'll just rename them. Instead of calling them the gods of, you know, fire and harvest and all this, we'll just rename your gods after the saints. We'll call this god Peter. This one Paul. We'll take your festivals and we'll give them Christian names. That's why the festival of Sol Invictus, the sun god, whose birthday is December 25th, suddenly became the birth of Jesus. That's why Ishtar and Astarte became Easter. She was a goddess of fertility. She was a spring goddess. That's why we call it Easter. Easter, Ishtar, a slight transliteration. And that's why you have colored eggs and rabbits associated with the resurrection of Jesus, because those are spring fertility symbols. And because Jesus wasn't born anywhere near December 25th, he wasn't born in winter. He would have froze to death in a barn in winter. There would not have been shepherds in the field in the winter because the sheep would have froze. Jesus was probably born in late summer because, again, shepherds in the field, late summer. But it has nothing to do with his birth. It has to do with amalgamating paganism and Christianity. And that's why you have all these odd symbols and festivals in Catholicism, because that's part of that amalgamation.
Ed, what do you think about the idea of when that is done, is it automatically a bad thing, or is it a good thing to hijack? Some people would argue like hijacking this pagan entity's holiday and then aiming all your worship at Christ is almost like sort of like sticking your nose up at this entity. And is there any value in that, or does it become valueless because you're predicating it on bad information in the sense that he wasn't born on that day?
Good question. And this is something that I've struggled with. And I still celebrate Christmas with my kids, but I know what I'm doing. I think it's about two things. One is about intention. And I know what the truth is. And my wife and I, we've had discussions back and forth. Should we still celebrate Christmas? I don't call Resurrection Day Easter because I just don't. But the whole Christmas thing, having a tree, I think that because I know that I'm not worshiping a pagan deity, again, I'm still conflicted about it, to be honest with you. Because the thing is, whenever you compromise, whenever good and evil compromise, evil always wins. No, you can't. If you take pure water and you put a drop of poison in it, well, you don't just get, you know, water that's a little, that, you know, that's just a little polluted. No, you just get diluted poison. So you have to be, if you're cognizant of what you're doing, then, you know, you go with it. It's the same thing like with any other agenda that you see out there. You know, if there's someone who is physically a male and he wants to call himself she, I'll call you she, but I'm not going, but especially where I live, I'd probably get fired if I didn't. But I know the truth. And I am being a part of the culture, but still remaining who I am. And I think there are biblical, not mandates, but there are biblical advice about that. You can be in the world, but not of the world. That's still have to function here.
Yeah, I'm wondering.
Render unto Caesar.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, don't get your head cut off for that. Yeah,
right.
There's a game we got to play. It's a thin line we got to walk. Go ahead, David. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say, maybe now when we celebrate Easter, it should be like, you know, obviously continue with the Christ-centric worship, but also throw the occasional, like, in your face, Ishtar, like that kind of crap, you know?
As a big fan of mocking small g gods, I'm like, stop doing that.
Exactly.
Not a good idea.
I think sometimes, because we can go overboard sometimes with certain things. Like, no, there was a church I was attending a while back when the Harry Potter books first came out, and they say, kids, you cannot read Harry Potter because it's, you know, it's witchcraft. I'm like, okay, I get what you're saying, but I mean, are you doing more harm than good? If you let them know, hey, this is just fantasy. This is no different than any other fantasy book you're reading. Mm-hmm. Just because you read a book about someone casting spells doesn't mean you're going to start casting spells. And there are people who disagree with me. And if your listeners do, hey, so be it. I'm not going to tell you you're wrong. Maybe I'm wrong and you're right. Maybe we should be, you know, extremely strict about it. And I know people who, there are people in the church you used to go to who were formerly witches who said, hey, you should not get anywhere near this stuff. And I respect that. And so I'm open to being wrong about it. But I also think we need, I think we need to be judicious in the way we, in what we do and how we do it.
You got to be careful too, because you tell a kid you can't do this, and that's what they're going to want to do. That's, and if you don't, you don't give them adequate reason, mm-hmm. as to why, it's like, well, listen, this is, you know, this is a glorification of witchcraft, and witchcraft is used in such and such. I mean, there's human sacrifice going on to this day. With the, explain it to them. Explain it to them what was going on in the olden days and today, and what this is talking about. It's just a clever, you know, disguise for pushing this idea into.
And you know what, Top? If you don't do a good enough job explaining it to them, you run the risk of them rebelling against the thing that is keeping them from enjoying it. It becomes a whole thing. But I do like what Victor Jones in the chat said. Christians are taking over all the pagan holidays. Toyota-thon is next. The Christians are coming for Toyota-thon.
There you go.
All right, so let's continue with these these churches.
Okay. So Pergamum it represents I would call it the medieval church of maybe like the fifth through the eighth century, the beginning of Catholicism. Then the next one you have is the Church of Thyatira. This was a church that they were praised by Jesus for their good works. They did a ton of good works, and it says that, you know, your good works will increase. However, he says, I have something against you in that you tolerate this woman Jezebel. So there's two ways to look at that. One is this Jezebel spirit, because, you know, the original Jezebel was, we saw her in the book of First Kings. She was married to the Israelite king Ahab, and she led the nation into idolatry.
Interesting fact about me. Yeah, first girlfriend named Jezebel. Go ahead.
Really?
Unbelievable.
Really. She's a very nice girl, though. She wasn't.
Yeah, that's not a good thing to name your daughter.
Yeah, they were retarded.
There we go.
Oh, shit.
But so that was the spirit of idolatry. So they, and what does idolatry have to do with the good works? Well, if you think that your good works are what's going to save you, then you've just made your works an idol. You made it over God. And that's why this church historically represents the Roman church of about the 8th century to about roughly to the 1500s, almost 1,000 years, where the Roman theocracy openly ruled the world. And there, and in the, and again, I want to make this clear. I am not anti-Catholic people. I'm against the hierarchy in the Vatican, because I think they've done some horribly evil things throughout history, but the people, I am not. My wife was raised Catholic, and obviously we get along fairly well because we married. My best friend, who was the best man at my wedding, he was also raised Catholic. They both are no longer, but they were raised that way. So I don't have anything against them. One of my best friends now is still a devoutly Catholic, and he and I, we kind of have a thing where we've called a truce. We used to have some serious battles over, we would have battles over email where there'd be like 13 pages long of my point, and then he would have a counterpoint as many pages long, and we copied all my friends on it, and they were like, dude, just stop. You guys are killing us.
You should print, like, make it a book, and that's basically what the Talmud is, right? It's just arguing.
Actually, I think I still have those emails buried in my Gmail somewhere, but he's a good person, love him to death. He's a great guy. We just disagree there. So I don't have a problem with the people. I want to make that clear, because I get accused of being anti-Catholic. I'm not against the people. I am against the hierarchy because of some of the evil that's been done there. But if you look at what Catholicism is about, it's really about your works. You are saved. Yes, you can. You believing in Jesus is the beginning of your salvation process, but then you have to take the Eucharist. You have to pray to Mary. You've got to confess to a priest. You give indulgences. You have to do all this stuff to be saved. You're not just saved by Jesus. And my friend who's Catholic agrees, because that was one of our points, is that he believes that he looks at the book of James where it says faith without works is dead. Yeah, your faith is dead if you aren't doing anything, but it doesn't mean that you're not saved by doing stuff. It just means that you can, it just means you have dead faith. You can have faith, but it's just worthless. If I say I believe in Jesus, now I'm going to go out and just, you know, do nothing, then your faith is worthless. It doesn't mean you don't have faith. Anyway, Catholicism is about works. And if you believe that you can, that your works can get you to heaven, then what do you need Jesus for? You don't. So your works becomes your idol. So Jesus said, it's great to do good works, but don't let the spirit of idolatry get in, replace, you know, the actual salvation message, which is you believe in Jesus. And as a result of the belief, you do good works. You don't good work, do good works to be saved. You do good works because you're saved. That's, and so that's what he told the church at Thyatira. And he told them, they know that if they, if they, you know, repent of that, then they will have rulership over the nations. So that's, again, that encapsulates the Catholic Church. And so, and a lot of Protestants love the Church of Thyatira. They love preaching on it because, yeah, they go off on the Catholics. However, the problem is, if the next period in history is Reformation, then the next church would be the Church at Sardis. And Sardis is one of the two churches about which Jesus has nothing positive to say. The Church at Sardis was the dead church. Now, the Church at Sardis in ancient Turkey was, it was a very small city. It was essentially like a castle on top of a hill. And it had this air of being impenetrable because it was very difficult to climb this hill. So armies would just not bother with it. It just wasn't worth it to go up there. So they had an image or a name that they were invincible. But once, and I go into detail on this on Faith by Reason, an opposing army sent a scout out to see if there was any way to get around this, the impregnability of this fortress. And he was watching one of the guards drop his helmet, and it rolled down the back of the hill. And then he saw that over time erosion had kind of almost cut like steps in the back, and that the guard went down those steps to get his helmet. And so the scout said, wait, here's how you do it. They have this air of impregnability, but they actually are vulnerable. And the other army came, and they went up the side of the hill where the steps were, and they came and conquered the city. The point of that is that Jesus says, his first words to Sardis is that you have a name that you live, but you're actually dead. In other words, they had a reputation for life, but the truth is they were not alive. They were not, and the good thing I defined life and death before. Life is the ability to repair. Death is the inability or unwillingness to repair. This church was unwilling to repair. Why? What does this have to do with the Reformation? Well, the Reformation did great things on salvation. They made it clear that salvation was by faith alone, not by works. However, one of the biggest reformers was John Calvin. And John Calvin has his 5 points of Calvinism. So I'm going to run the risk of offending the Calvinists who are listening. And it'll be a lot of people, because a lot of our modern churches are based on those five fundamentals of Calvinism. One, the first is, I think, is total depravity. We call it two. So go ahead.
This is why I asked you to come on, because I know that your take is going to be not out there, but it's going to, it'll rub a lot of people the wrong way, I think people need to hear it. I don't care.
So the first aspect of Calvinism is total depravity, which means we cannot be holy. And I agree with that. I think we are human beings. We are flawed. The U I didn't have my notes in front of me. So it's total depravity. It is that we have, basically it's about predestination. I'll just encapsulate it there. I'm not gonna remember all the parts of it, because I know that there's irresistible faith. There's perseverance of the saints. So basically Calvinism says that you are predestined, that God has predestined you before you were born to either be saved or unsaved. And there's nothing you can do about it. If God has predestined you to be saved, then that's where irresistible grace comes in. At some point you will be saved because God chose you before time. Oh, cool. You have it up there. Okay. Yeah. Total depravity. Thank you. Unconditional election. That's what it is. Okay. Unconditional election. God chose you. He just said, you know, Top, you're going to be with me. Ed, sorry, son, you're going to hell. And there's nothing you do. It's unconditional. And then you have limited atonement, meaning that Jesus' death was not for everyone. It was only for those who God chose. And then you have irresistible faith with irresistible grace, meaning again, that if could say, Top, you were, God said, you are my chosen one. I want you to be a part of me. And you can say, I don't want it. God forget you. At some point, his grace is irresistible. You are going to be dragged kicking and screaming to be a Christian. And the P is perseverance of the saints, meaning that once you're saved, you can never lose your salvation.
Today's episode is brought to you by PurgeSuddenly.com. What if I told you that more people have died from parasites than have ever died from war? What if I told you that cancer, multiple sclerosis, acne, rosacea, and rheumatoid arthritis can all be treated with parasite medication? Rid your body of these all too common parasites. Purge Parasite Cleanse is made with ingredients like zinc, carrot powder, garlic, black walnut. We're talking all natural ingredients that are good for you. Or try their Digestimes to promote healthy gut bacteria and aid in digestion. These, as well as any other products on PurgeSuddenly.com, can be purchased with promo code Nephilim, N-E-P-H-I-L-I-M, at PurgeSuddenly.com.
There are problems with these.
All of these are nonsense, but I agree with the I, because I have said the same thing. I said, I don't want anything to do with this, and here I am kicking and screaming, so there might be something to...
You know, Calvinists, they must really appreciate the idea of the NPC, right? that some people just aren't
NPCs.
Functioning. You know, they're not real characters in this entire experience, and that to me aligns with, you know, okay, well then some people just aren't meant to be saved or won't be saved or predestined to not be saved. And then some people would go, well, that would be an NPC then. That's an interesting concept.
It also puts some interesting limitations on God, on a God that you think is...
It makes God unjust, because it takes away your choice. If God chose me and not you, then I don't have free will. And it also makes it God's fault for everyone who's in hell. Everyone who's in hell is there because God decided that you're going to hell. That means that God decided before you were even born, before you were even a baby, when you were completely innocent, God already decided, yep, you're going to hell. That doesn't sound just to me.
No,
it also says that no matter who you are, you're going to heaven anyway, and whether you like it or not. So the good news is, hey, everyone in heaven is there because God chose them. That also means that everyone who's in hell is there because God chose that as well. It means that you have no choice.
This may be a little bit off of the topic, but do you think that there is such thing as someone being irredeemable? Like that some people are just beyond redemption? Mm-hmm. Because I personally don't think that. I don't think that means that I have to like a person, but their eternal salvation and relationship with God doesn't hinge on whether or not I like them. So when people get really upset, they go, oh, did name an evil historical figure. Well, Dr. did they Fauci. Get Dr. Fauci? Is Dr. Fauci going to get redemption? Is that okay? It just means you can act however you want and you can find redemption in the end and salvation. And it's like, well, I don't have to like Dr. Fauci, you know, but I don't think that anybody is beyond redemption. I don't think that you could put limitations on God in that way. And I think as long as that's genuinely your choice, is to repent and to ask for forgiveness, then that's there for us.
As long as you have the ability to choose, you can be redeemed. Now, here's the thing. If you live a life of, you know, debauchery, and on your deathbed, you say, okay, I'm dying now. If you're lucky enough to, you know, be, I won't say control your death, but, you know, be at a time where you know you're going to die and you don't die in an accident or something. And you can do that. You can have a genuine deathbed confession, but you're not going to have any reward.
Mm.
When you get to the afterlife, you will be, you know, saved by the skin of your teeth. But someone else, let's say, who lived a good life, who was saved early on and spent their life, you know, doing the right thing by God and obeying God and helping others and, you know, loving and all that stuff, they're going to have a huge reward. And you know, Jesus talks about this in his teachings and his parables. If you break them down, Jesus' teachings were in two categories. They were either salvation or reward. They were either you know, what you might have to do to be saved and avoid hell, or your reward. You know, the parable of the talents, when, you know, one guy was given one talent, one was given five, one was given 10. The guys with 5 and 10 talents, they went out and they worked and they doubled it and God said, okay, you're over 10 cities now, and you're over 5 cities. But the one with one talent, he buried it, didn't do anything with it. He was still saved, but he had no reward. So when people say it's not fair that someone can live a bad life and then confess at the end and have somebody who lives, you know, a good, pious life and they, you know, and they die, it's not fair. Well, it is in the afterlife, because justice will be meted out, and we'll talk about that down the road a bit. So why would Calvinism and those beliefs render you unable to repair? Because repair, in order to repair, you have to admit that there's something wrong. If you are predestined for heaven, why do you need to grow? You have no incentive to repair. You have no incentive to grow. You have no incentive to do good works. I'm already going to heaven. I've been predestined. Because I prayed the sinner's prayer, that means that God chose me before I was even born. There's no point in growing. If you're not growing, if you're not repairing, then you're dead. And so Jesus said, hold on to that which you have, which is still alive. And the only thing that they had, which was their salvation. So he basically told this church, you guys, you know, you're not doing well. The best you can do is just be saved at this point, because you're not doing good works. You're not growing. If you're not growing, you're not alive. Every one of us, our cells are dividing. You know, well, we've all reached adulthood, but, you know, I have two young boys. They're growing. You're getting taller every day. But then, you know, when they reach adulthood, your cells are still dividing and growing and repairing. You're alive. But once you stop doing that and become stagnant, then you're not alive anymore. You're dead. You're no use to anyone.
You're talking about 35, right? That's when you start to everything. Just,
yeah, right. You started. But you can still repair.
Okay.
And I'm there too. I'm older than you guys. My knees make noise now. I wake up with things hurting. I have no idea why this hurts, but I'm, you know, still alive. I'm still repairing. So that's what he told this church. And he also told them that they have to be watchful. So they weren't watchful. If you're completely saved and you are chosen and you can't lose your salvation no matter what, then again, there's no point in doing anything. So the question is, can you lose your salvation? No, but you can give it up. God will not take away your salvation, but you can stop believing. You have a choice. So that's kind of a counter to the whole once saved, always saved. And that's again, controversial. A lot of Christians believe that once you get saved, then God will not allow you to ever be unsaved.
I think a great explanation or an example of that is Kanye West right now. As you're kind of describing it, listen, I don't really know what's going on with the guy, if this is all a show, but you went from, you know, Jesus is king to my wife's walking down Paris naked with no shoes on. And it's like, whoa, what happened? You're opening up a porn agency? Like,
yeah,
I don't know.
That guy, I think he just has some serious, he needs serious, I think he's bipolar. I mean, I have my degrees in psychology. I think he is seriously bipolar and he needs help. And I think he's too arrogant to really get the help he needs. I think he has some serious mental issues.
Well, I think for him too, it's probably they would love to, based off of those text messages from his handler, they would love to drug him into oblivion. And so I think it's very, you don't know who to trust. I'm sure he struggles with that a lot, you know, and not to apologize on behalf of the guy or anything like that. But I always look at him and I'm like, man, I couldn't imagine being subjected to the hurdles that guy's being subjected to.
Mm. So, I'm sorry, something's beeping.
It's a beeper.
I don't know if that's me or you guys.
That's not me, no.
Okay, hold on a second. Give me 1 second. Let me find out what's going on here.
But yeah, the idea of Kanye West I would originally push back like with the mental illness on him, but I do think that he does have some sort of mental illness. And after talking with Marzinski and all that, it's like, I just think this dude is the mental illness, what we're describing as an illness, is probably just a proclivity to be able to talk with or be influenced by, you know, entities more readily.
And yeah, I think that he's being He is the center of a tug of war match.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If you believe in that, in what we talk about, the entities that do want these influential people to do whatever. I mean, like, they're pulling real hard on the Jesus side, and then they're pulling real hard on the, you know, the other side, the Nephilim side. And that guy is just like, he's an open antenna, and he's being pulled back and forth. I don't know if the drugs will do it for him, because that's like, those are like sedatives, you know. It's not gonna.
No, I don't think drugs don't solve the issue. I mean, that you need to repair whatever's going on in your mind. And if there's demonic influence, that obviously needs to be repaired as well. And I agree. I think he's going back and forth. I think he knows that he's on the wrong side. And I think that's why he does goes back to the Jesus stuff. And then, you know, in his records about that, you know, doing his Sunday worship message or records. If you look at some of these, like, even look at some of these heavy metal guys who, you know, seem demonic, the Ozzy Osbourne types, they're covered with crosses. They have tattoos of crosses everywhere. Because I think they know that I've gone too far. I need, I need to get back. And they recognize that they're you know, gazing into the abyss.
That's why I always try to give these people a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, just because it doesn't mean that you should champion them or make them your heroes, but it's like, they're probably much closer to seeing the definitive proof that this is spiritual warfare than the vast majority of us will ever be. As far as like
they're not
being able to see it.
They've peeled off the rat race, or the, you know, like the financial issues that most people have in the bottom of, like, I need to do this to get, they're like well beyond that. So they're seeing from, you know, a higher vantage point, and they definitely see it. But let's talk about Revelation.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm almost done with the churches, and we can wrap up. So that was Sardis. They were told to be watchful, but I want to wrap up with this of Sardis. They said, Jesus says, if you are not watchful, I will come upon you as a thief, and you will not know when I come. So a lot of people see that, you know, Jesus will come as a thief. That means he's sneaky and that sort of thing. Because we equate being a thief with just being sneaky. And we're going to talk about the rapture next time. That's going to be fun, because that's going to piss everybody off when I talk about my
Ed, just so I can focus in here, because this is, I'm somebody who's looking at this from the vantage point of not having this this background. Mm-hmm. We are, these churches, you said earlier, they are representations of different empires, right? So this is like
different eras.
Okay. Yes. Okay. All right. So they just want to keep that in mind.
They feel like interpretations of different people too. Like the first one that you talked about was like not just an era of Christianity, but like an actual archetype of me being a Christian. It's amazing how many layers there are to.
Yeah, almost like I said, I struggle with the Ephesus stuff. I'm strong on doctrine. I need to be stronger on love. You have other people who are being persecuted. I mean, in other parts of the world, we don't get as much in the U.S. We get, you know, more verbal persecution and cultural persecution as Christians. But, you know, you go to China, you go to Indonesia, you go to, you know, Islamic countries.
Ukraine.
Ukraine. You're getting physically persecuted, and you're supposed to endure. Compromise. We all compromise. Look, we just talked about the whole Christmas thing. Is that a compromise? Maybe. But we all compromise with the world for our comfort. And we all are idols of our good works. You know, a lot of times I think, hey, I'm doing this great work. I've got these podcasts and this blog. I'm doing great. But I have to stay cognizant of the fact that I can't worship what I'm doing. I'm not doing this for myself. I'm doing this for others. You know, I'm trying to teach others this, and I'm not saved because of what I do. And then the debt part of us, some of us get complacent and lazy and thinking, hey, you know, I've got mine. You know, I don't need to grow anymore. Because we naturally don't want to grow. We want comfort, but you can't pursue comfort and growth. You have to pursue one or the other. And growth is painful. You know, you work out. You want to build muscle. You don't build muscle by laying on the couch eating Cheetos. You got to work out. It hurts. It's painful, but, you know, the rewards are there. So we all individually and as communities deal with all of these things. And that's why these letters are so profound in so many different layers. But I wonder, wrapping up with the whole watchful thing, he said, he'll come upon you as a thief. What does a thief do? A thief is not just someone who's sneaky. A thief is someone who takes something. So it says Jesus will come and take something if you are not watchful. And the church of Sardis was not watching. And I think that's really going to be germane to what I'm going to talk about with the rapture next time. So that's that church. Then you have last two churches. You have the church of Philadelphia, not to be confused with our current Philadelphia, which is a different kind of city. But this, you know, Philadelphia means brotherly love. This was the faithful church. This is the church that Jesus said to them, because you have faith and because you've held on to my name, I'm going to set before you an open door. an open door to my home, and I'm going to write the name of my father on you. So he's going to give you the family name, and you will be a pillar in the temple of God, meaning you will have a permanent residency. So what is Jesus saying to the church? I'm inviting you to my house. I want you to be a permanent resident, and I'm giving you the family name. Jesus is proposing to this church. This church is his bride. He's saying, because you've held on to my name and remained faithful, this is what I'm going to do for you. And importantly, to the rapture thing, which we'll talk about next time, he says, because you have kept true to my name, I'm going to keep you from the time of tribulation, of trial that's coming upon the earth. The word keep you from is the word ek in Greek. It means I will keep you physically out of, I will physically remove you from this time of trial that's coming upon the earth. This is the tribulation, and this is another rapture point. Again, we'll get into it more, but I want to make sure that that's there. I'll refer to it again. So this church represents the era of the missionary period, which is you had the Catholic period with Thyatira, you had the Reformation from about the 1500s to roughly the 1800s. Then you had the missionary church of the 1800s and early 1900s. This was a time of the Great Awakenings. You had all these great preachers like Sturgeon and Wilberforce and like all these great pastors who came along, and they spread the gospel throughout the world. There was a huge revival in Christianity. It was this revival is what spawned the United States. You know, the U.S. was a part of that, and a part of, you know, the Puritan aspect of it. Many of the founders, yes, many of them were deists, absolutely. You know, Benjamin Franklin was a deist, George Washington was, but you also have some very, you know, strong revivalist Christians like John Adams, for example, and there are others there. But they are the ones who founded this nation on those principles. And that's why for at least 150 years, this was just the greatest nation and most prosperous nation in the world. And of course, we fell off from that. We'll get that in the next one. But that's that period of time from I would say about the 1700s, 1800s to about, say, roughly World War II, where the church was growing and expanding. And then you have the final church, was the church at Laodicea. This was a church that would not take a stand. It says, Jesus said, I know your works. I know that you are neither hot nor cold. Means hot means you're for Jesus. You're 100% on fire for him. Cold means that you're the opposite. You know, you're falling away. He says, because you're lukewarm and you are neither hot or cold, I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth. But Jesus basically said this church made him sick.
Hey, Ed, can I just say that this is like, you know, I hope this isn't a obviously moment, but I think of the church today and their complacency and their willingness to adopt worldly views and sort of compromise every which way just to almost, it doesn't even seem to bring in followers of the church as much as it is just to stay relevant and stay part of the conversation. They're willing to do I've seen debaucherous things, you know what I mean? Where it's like, I've seen them host some sort of drag queen events in churches, you know, this was not that long ago at all. So when you're saying like, neither hot nor cold, and that's just where my mind is going. No,
you nailed it. That's okay. Exactly what it is. They won't take a stand. It's because they have so much stuff, so many riches, that they don't want to take a stand one way or the other because they don't want to lose what they have. They knew if they became really on fire and were very strong on doctrine, well, they would lose some of their membership. But on the other hand, if they outright rejected God, well, then they would lose other membership. So let's just stay right in the middle. Let's not be offensive.
You know what's funny?
That's our current postmodern church.
As you're saying this, like through these seven churches, I'm a musician, so I'm thinking about, I just looked up the modes to make sure I had them right, where you have Ionian, Phrygian, Lydian, Mixolydian, and the last one is Locrian. And Locrian is it's the seventh note of the scale before it repeats itself in the octave. Mm-hmm. And it's based off of a diminished 7 flat and 5th, which is like a diminished chord. I don't know if you've heard it before, but it's like three dissonant notes that do not go with each other. And then the next mode is Ionian again, which is the major, the ah, C major. We're back to something that makes sense and is whole. And then it goes back through those steps again from minors to majors to the most dissonant and then back and resolves itself. I don't know. I'm thinking of like the overlap there of those seven churches. And this seventh one is the worst one and is the worst sound. But if applied correctly, it could be beautiful, beautiful passing chords.
And then what comes next seems to be good order.
Right. No, that's awesome. I love that. I want to learn more about that. That's interesting because I think that God speaks to us on so many levels. And he wants to hammer his message home to us in so many different ways that it would not surprise me if those chords resonated in some way with the themes of these churches.
This is funny right here because Top does this, and every time he does it, I enjoy it. But the audience knows Top bringing back to sound and frequency. Oh, no. But like, I don't think that he should be sorry because I believe it was Nikola Tesla, right? That famously said, and I know he likes this quote, but that if you want to.
All right.
What's the quote, Top, by Nikola Tesla? If you want to understand the world,
yeah, you have to understand vibration, frequencies, and something
else. Yeah, I'm with it. Everything is vibrations.
So this would be your C major chord, right?
Okay.
It's beautiful. Okay. The Locrian, the seventh of that would be this. It's a B diminished. You hear how that's almost like mysterious and strange?
Yeah.
Not very pleasant, but when it resolves into the C. You're like, oh, feels great again. Anyway, there's your
music. That's interesting. That was dope. That was awesome.
So if the first one is like, say, the Ephesian church, which was strong on doctrine, if you combine that with, you know, maybe if the Laodicean church kind of got with the Ephesian church, you'd have more of a melody because you'd have two extremes.
Mm. Yeah. There's a lot to that. I don't know.
Everything that, especially when you bring up this sound and frequency thing, Juan Ayala, shout out Juan, when he talks about the Bible, he talks about it as a book that is alive on so many levels that there's, you know, there's the literal translation, but then there's also the historical context. There is a, what would you call it? Like not a metaphor, but an allegorical.
Yeah.
But then there's also like this alchemical, there's also like a numerological code within it. Like there is it's so layered. It's almost why I feel like a lot of people can't like I have trouble reading it because it makes me feel stupid. If I read something else, it's like, it's not insulting me. If I read, you know, whatever the book is like, it wants me to read it. If I read the Bible in the very same way that we talked about how we have forgotten how to absorb and translate symbols and their meanings, it's the Bible does not care if you don't know how to do that. So if you don't know how to do that and you don't know how to understand it, you can come away feeling stupid. And that's very much how I felt in the past. I'm like, this feels high level for some reason, but rightfully so, because it is.
Think of how many, it's funny, how many people call the Bible stupid? And it's like, no, you're stupid.
No, you're stupid. Yes. Like,
there's a reason it's been around forever, and it has so many different meanings, and you're going to sit there with your infinite knowledge and call it stupid. It's like, okay. Yes.
Right. Yeah, whenever I hear, you know, because I'm a big fan of comedy. I mean, I listen to comedians all the time on my, like, Sirius XM. When I'm driving around, I've got all the comedy stations on. You know, inevitably, you have some comedian come on who will say, oh, the Bible's dumb. I'm like, no, exactly. No, you are. Just because you don't understand something doesn't make you dumb. Like, oh, this particle physics is, this is stupid. What do you mean an atom? What the heck's an atom?
Yeah. No,
you're just showing how dumb you are because you're just saying, I don't understand it. And I'm gonna make fun of something I don't understand.
Right. Yeah. Whereas, I mean, I tell my own son, right, who's 8 years old, where he goes, I'm not good at a thing. And I tell him, like, bold face, in order to be good at anything, you have to start by sucking at it. Yeah. You know, so if you look at everything from the point of like, well, I'm stupid and I don't understand this yet, you're going to be a lot better off because that's the first step in beginning to understand it. So when you read the Bible and you go, this seems dumb, like I always just said, this kind of highlights how dumb I am. Not really.
The program, this is, again, another tangent. The program I used to graphic design, I wanted to do it, always drew my whole life. And I said, let me delve into graphic designing. Bought this program, couldn't figure out how to create a shape, a vector, a fill, a stroke. I had no idea. And I was like, this program is the dumbest thing in the world. And I actually closed my iPad. I put it away for like 2 months. And I said, let me try it again. And I tried it again. I was like, oh, I'm an idiot. And now I figured out how to manipulate it beyond, you know, like most people's capabilities. But it's like, I'm stupid. I need to like humble myself come back to the drawing board and see what I'm doing wrong. And then, you know, then you could make real like retarded stuff like this.
And that's contrastive. That's contrastive thinking. We talked about that before with the jelly bean thing. I gave you that example last time. It's contrastive thinking. If you go into saying, hey, I could be wrong, I don't know, then you're open to it. But if you say, I know, this is dumb, you've just closed your mind off.
Mm-hmm.
You've just made it impossible to learn because you think, well, I already know. I know what this is. I know it. Like when people say, well, you know, Jesus came to bring a message of love. That's really it. Did you actually read what he said? Have you read that? Because he came to die for your sins. That's what he said he came to do. But are you taking what you've heard in greeting cards and colloquial sayings and you reject everything else? Jesus said, turn the other cheek. That's not all he said. He said a lot of other stuff. If you put it all in context, you get a different message. But anyway, that's another rabbit hole. I'm not going to go down because I know we're getting short on time.
The letters to the church are exactly what you're talking about, where he's hitting every aspect of what you need.
Because we all, you know, we all like our comfort.
And he's setting it the way that you're presenting it. It sounds as though he was, you might even say, like, ruthless in his critique.
Mm-hmm. Very. Oh, dude, if you really read not just, you know, these seven letters, but if you read the Gospels, Jesus was hardcore. I mean, he called his disciples stupid. I mean, he doesn't say those exact words, because if you're reading it in the polite King James, he'll say, oh, though you guys are just slow of learning. That's basically saying you're an idiot.
Yeah, basically slow of learning.
He's not lying. That's and this is before we started the show. I said the reason I do what I do is because, like, I don't. If we're continuing to not say things, we're lying. Mm. And the best way to avoid that is just say exactly what you mean and be direct and to the point, and people get it. Unless you're telling a parable, which is he's very good at that too. But he's also very direct in the Bible.
Yeah, he is extremely direct. I mean, he would tell. You know, there's the story about when a Gentile woman, because, you know, he came to the Jews first. That's what he was there for. He was there to be the anointed one, the Messiah, the Mashiach of the Jews. And a Gentile woman came to him asking for healing. And Jesus tests her, and he said, you know, it's not right to give the children's food to the dogs. He basically called her, he didn't call her directly a dog, but he's like comparing her to one. And she said, well, yeah, but even the dogs eat the crumbs from the table. Jesus, okay, you pushed into me. I pushed back against you. You pushed in. I can tell you want it. And he healed her. But that didn't sound like a nice way to do it. What was he doing? He was challenging her to see, how bad do you want this? So that's not the kind, sweet, magic teddy bear that we always think of him as. No, yeah. Jesus was hardcore.
That's one of the things that I think is a mechanism by which they turn people off from Christianity.
Right.
I think it's something that has been, it's like, a straw man has been created over time, and that straw man is incredibly unappealing, and on the surface even looks weak and gullible and all these different things, and that it's not the case. It's a bad representation, but people fight the straw man, and they go, no, I don't want to be associated with that.
Because Jesus is just as big, you know, he's this tall, bearded, long-haired hippie walking around saying, peace and love, brother.
Right.
not really.
He looked nothing like that, and that was not his message.
I like the idea of... pushing back against Jesus or against God, about testing the spirit.
Yeah.
Because that's something that one of our friends we spoke to on the show, he's experiencing some like entities and things like that, and he's not sure which way they're coming from. And Tony Merkel actually gave him the great advice of test the spirit. Like, that's actually something that we should be doing, like push back.
And I'll say this, God is okay being challenged. That's something that, you know, we don't really think about. But when you read it, when you read the Bible, you see that not only is God okay being challenged, he welcomes it. Remember the story of Abraham with Lot, and when, you know, and in Sodom and Gomorrah, when, you know, God said he was gonna destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And what did Abraham do? He started negotiating. He said, well, if you find any holy people there, will you destroy it? Job said, no, I won't. So he was okay with being pushed back against. So he's fine with that. He didn't make us automatons. We're not NPC. Hopefully, most of us are not NPCs. He wants to interact with us. And interaction means going back and forth. So you can challenge him and say, is this really from you? Because I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to do this until I know. I do this all the time. Like, you know what? I think this is what you're saying to me, but I'm not going to move until I know 100% it's from you. And I think he honors that.
I do the same. Oh. I do the same thing. I'm doing it right now. So hopefully, pray that I get some answers.
So I'm going to wrap up with talking about how the end of the church. So Laodicea is the final church. And, you know, they were the ones. Jesus ends with a scathing indictment of Laodicea. He says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him and dine with him." Now, a lot of churches have used this as like their benediction. You know, behold, or their altar call, you know, calling people to be Christians. But when you actually look at it in context, Jesus is a scathing indictment of the church. Jesus says, "Behold, I'm outside of the church knocking to come in. I'm standing at the door knocking." That means Jesus isn't even in this church. He's like knocking to come in. And he's saying, if anyone in there hears and comes out to me, then I will be with you. But he's saying this church is like, this church is done. I'm sick of them. If any of you are in this church, want to be with me, listen to me for knocking and come out of the church and come to me. So that's why this is the church in the worst shape. And unfortunately, I believe it coincides with our modern church, which, again, won't take a stand on anything and just wants to be comfortable. So how does a church age end? My thought, and I do this throughout Faith by Reason, where I talk about what, for lack of a better term, the dispensations. And I hate using that term because people will say, "Well, you're a dispensationalist and you believe all these things that the dispensationalists believe." And I don't. I just use dispensation to denote different eras of time where God deals with people differently. You have the dispensation of innocence with Adam and Eve. He dealt with them a certain way. Then after that, you had the next dispensation with the flood, where the Nephilim were, and he dealt with people differently. Then you had the patriarch, and then you have the law, then you have this grace. Each one of those dispensations ended when man chose themselves over God. The age of innocence with Adam and Eve ended when they decided to choose themselves over God. The flood, that era ended, or the antediluvian period ended when people chose the fallen angels and the Nephilim over God. The era of the patriarch with Abraham, that ended when Pharaoh chose himself over God. And then the law, the era of the law ended when, again, they had Jesus there and they said, "Nope, we don't want you. We choose ourselves over you." So how would the church, if that's true, and it may not be, but that's my theory, how would the church age end? How would the church choose themselves over God? Well, there's an interesting thing that happened in the 60s, something called the Godless Christianity Movement. It was during this time when, you know, during the 60s, it was a very turbulent period of time when, you know, there was a lot of secularism and atheism creeping into universities, and Christianity was being challenged as it hadn't been challenged before. People were asking the questions, you know, if God is good, why is there evil in the world? You know, so forth and so on. And the church didn't have answers. And that's when the whole God is dead movement came around. There's that famous cover of Time magazine that says, "Is God dead?" And the church basically decided to go without a definitive definition of God, without a orthodox definition of God. That means that they decided God can be whatever you want him to be when you are worshiping him. That's Laodicean, because we're not going to define God. God is just whatever we want him to be. So we're not going to take a stand.
And in that way, that's self-worship, because it's self-preservation.
Yes. Yep.
It's abandoning the word of God to preserve yourself.
Yeah. If you define what God is, then you're greater than God. Mm. If you're greater than God, then what you're worshiping is the God you created. So that's you worshiping yourself over God. So that's how I believe that this age is going to end. And I think that means that we are in that stage now. So if the dispensation technically ended in the 60s, well, where are we now? Well, I frankly think that we're being given one more generation to repent. Mm-hmm. And because if you look at the way all the dispensations end, they don't end immediately. Like when the Nephilim came down, you know, God still gave them 120 years of Noah building the ark. They still had a period of time. You know, when Jesus came and died and rose again, there were still 40 years before Israel was destroyed by the Roman Empire.
Jerusalem. So yeah.
It could be that he gives us one more generation to get it right. But I think we're fast approaching the end of that. And when the church ends, then we go to the next stage, which is which would be Revelation chapter 4, which is what we'll start talking about next time. But I'm going to talk about that ultimate controversy in eschatology, which is the rapture. So we'll talk about that next time and then get into. So this is kind of like the most grounded episode we're going to have. After this, we're going to get way into the supernatural stuff.
After this, we're getting crazy. This is a great episode.
Yeah, dude. And I mean, it was masterfully done right there. He was like, and then we're going to get into the eschatology of chapter 4. And I was like, man, this guy's good. Has he done these before?
You would swear it's almost like he's done 60 of these.
You think I've done that before? Yeah, you think I've done this a couple times before? Yeah.
Oh man, your website looks great on mobile. It doesn't look so great, but on desktop it looks really clean.
If you guys want to, please feel free to give me any pointers on that. I mean, it could be right because I'm using WordPress, and maybe I need to upgrade to something else. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's supposed to be mobile friendly, but
sometimes the theme, if it's an older theme, it's a whole thing. I'll talk to you later about it. But guys, go to his website, faithbyreason.net, and I guess if you're available next week, we'll do this again.
Yeah, I think I should be. I would say if we keep doing this Fridays, the only Friday I won't be available is like probably the last week of May, because I'm actually going on June 1st to go on a little family trip. But I'll inform you ahead of time. Tell you what, I'll get with you later on today or tomorrow, and send you an email, let you know what my availability is for next Friday.
Perfect. I'm excited. I know the people watching are excited, and thank you again for coming on.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week. I don't know what we have planned next week. Anything, David?
I don't know what's going on next week either. I live day by day. But guys, don't forget, go to patreon.com/NephilimDeathSquad if you want to support the show, if you want access to the Telegram to come and hang and chat, talk about this content. You can do so by going to patreon.com/NephilimDeathSquad. And other than that, I guess that's it.
That's it. All right, guys. We'll see you later. Peace out.
The greatest hypnotist on planet Earth is a oblong box in the corner of the room. It is constantly telling us what to believe is real.
If you can persuade them that what they see with their eyes is what there is to see, you've got them. Because they'll laugh in the face of an explanation that portrays the bigger picture of what's happening. And they have.